and welcome back to CoronaCast.
Hello.
In this episode, we're going to be talking to my friend, Dr. Ben, again about, well, a further update from intensive care and also get a better insight into what happens when patients go there.
Yeah, and what it means to go into intensive care and the process of that.
But first, a bit about what we've been up to. So this week, Tilly did an audition online.
Yeah, my first audition online. So I've actually done two online technically, but one was a self-tape, so I recorded it beforehand, and one was a Zoom meeting thing for an audition.
That must have felt really weird, not being there in person.
It was the weirdest experience of my life. Like, it was completely different to an audition, because in a sense it's not, you're still talking to this person face to face and doing your monologues, but like, it normally you go and you can like feel the room and you can get a feel for the school that you're auditioning for yourself. But like, nope, I could not get that at all. I did not know how it went down. Didn't know, like, it was honestly so weird.
The people sounded really nice. I was having a little earwig along the corridor,
which I found out afterwards. Yeah, the people were lovely. It wasn't anything to do with that. It was just, like, the people were nice. They were like, this is new for us as well. You just, like, it was just so weird, like, waiting in this Zoom virtual waiting room and then the screen suddenly popping up with these people.
I could never do something like that.
It was very difficult. But, and also it was so weird afterwards, because I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know how that went. But then, like, an hour later, it felt like it didn't happen, because I was like, still, I'd been at home all day.
And
anything you've been up to recently, Mum?
I've just been working, doing yoga.
Oh yeah,
chatting to my friends online, the usual.
Mm-hmm.
So next, my disclaimer. So we'll be giving out some advice in this podcast. I'm a GP, but I'm not an infectious diseases or public health expert. And opinions expressed are my own and not on behalf of an organisation. So, first, a question.
This is from Liz in Guildford. She said, "Hi Hannah and Tilly, I was interested to hear your thoughts on face masks in the last CoronaCast episode. I've since had an email from a local independent clothes shop that is making cotton masks and selling them for delivery. Would these work, do you think? Would a machine wash between uses be effective, do you think? Keep up the great work."
Thank you, Liz. So I had a look further on in her email at these face masks that are being produced by a local company, and following on really from what I said in the last episode, I do think that covering the nose and mouth when you're out and about is a good idea. There is evidence to show that this stops people spreading the disease when they have it and stops people getting it from other people, mainly the former, so stopping it spreading if you are infectious with the disease. So I would say face covering is a good idea, and these masks are actually triple layered, so there's three layers of fabric, and I think it's a good idea. The only thing is, of course, that you need to not touch the mask when you're wearing it, and when you take it off you need to be careful not to touch it, and then you should wash it regularly like you suggest. So I would say washing, you know, at least one every day you wear it is a very good idea.
Would you say, like, put it in the washing machine or just kind of soak it in soap and water?
In the washing machine.
Yeah.
Okay. If that's an option for you, is the best idea.
Okay. And also I would ask, I guess, like, obviously this is a nice idea if it works, but would you say anything about being careful of being ripped off with this kind of thing? Like the price.
Definitely. And yeah, obviously I can't, from a scientific point of view, I can't endorse any products or anything. It's just that the principle of covering nose and mouth when out in public makes sense, and there is evidence to support doing that. Yeah, and there are going to be companies that try to draw on people's fear. So you need to be really careful about these kind of things. They, you know, check the price. Don't pay over the odds for something like this. Be aware that there are companies who are going to take advantage of your fear.
Yeah, but I guess with the masks, if they're not too expensive, and well, these particular ones, and they work, and they're worth it, then they're very pretty masks. So
they are. Yeah, they're a nice idea in a way.
Hopefully it it's useful.
And I'm sure in the coming months, there's designer masks are going to
become a thing. How weird is that?
Yeah.
Masks will be the new fashion.
And you'll need more than one of these masks, obviously, if you're going to be washing them regularly.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay. So now we're on to the interview with Ben.
Yes. Thank you very much, Ben, for doing this interview with us. In light of recent events, we thought it might be appropriate to do this interview about ICU because there seems to be a lot of confusion around what it actually is and what it means to go and why people are going during when they have really bad coronavirus.
It is quite detailed, and there are some quite, I suppose, distressing things that Ben talks about. So we wanted to warn you about that.
Yeah, it's not meant to scare you. All it's meant to do is give a better understanding of what it is and what it means to go there.
Because I think it can be the scariest things are the things that you don't know about. Mm. The unknown is a scary thing. So yeah, hopefully this exactly. will remove some of that kind of fear because you will understand it better.
Yeah.
So over to Ben. Thank you very much for rejoining us on CoronaCast, Ben. Lovely to talk to you again, and would be great to hear an update from your end. So in about the last week and a half since we talked to you, how are things?
It's lovely to be back. So I've been on and off working on the intensive care unit, either on long days or on nights. So around 13-hour shifts, including handover, sort of on and off since then. How has it been? Well, we've seen, I think, a steady increase in numbers of cases of patients that we, as the critical care team, have had to see, who are obviously the sickest people really with coronavirus in the hospital. And we've seen an increase in the numbers of people that are being referred to us. But at the same time, we have increased the number of staff that is on the shop floor to deal with that. So although there has been an increase in numbers, it's felt much more manageable than it was, I think, initially when we were still trying to cope with the standard number of people that would be on the shop floor.
Yeah, so you've increased the number of staff. And have you increased the number of beds then as well?
So our capacity just keeps expanding, and as long as we continue to have ventilators, which at the moment we do have, which we've pulled a lot of those ventilators from theatres, it means that we can keep expanding the numbers that we're looking after until we run out of the relevant equipment that we would need to support people.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Okay, so I'm glad to hear things are under control for now, but I guess, you know, time will tell, and numbers do seem to be increasing still steadily. So,
yeah.
At the moment, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, has gone to intensive care at St. Thomas's Hospital, and a lot of people are talking about that and wondering about it. And I think there's generally a bit of a lack of understanding about what going to intensive care actually means. So can you tell us a bit about why the decision would be made to move a patient to intensive care with coronavirus, and what would happen and what the considerations would be when they do go there?
Yeah, certainly, yeah. So I think there's a lot of misconception about what the critical care team can deliver in intensive care. And I think there's a sort of a myth that when somebody gets extremely unwell, the intensive care team come and swoop down and pick them up and take them to the intensive care unit and make them better. That's not what we do. What we offer in an intensive care is essentially a means of supporting a patient's organs, which are failing, whilst the patient gets better for themselves. And what I mean by that, or until we can have a definitive treatment that can fix the problem that's underlying them needing intensive care. So if we look at, for instance, the coronavirus, the main problem patients have that require us to see them is the fact that they can no longer provide enough oxygen for their bodies through their lungs. And what we offer in intensive care is the ability to take that person to intensive care, to sedate them, pass a breathing tube down, which allows us then to basically do the work of breathing for the patients. In other words, we ventilate the patient on a machine, and we can provide we can do a lot of things on the machine which allow us to improve the oxygen delivery via the ventilators, which we couldn't do if the patient was still breathing. So that's number one. So what we do is if they've got a failing organ, we can provide various machines and various technologies allow us to be able to support the patient until their lungs have recovered themselves.
A lot of that is to do with pressures, isn't it?
That's right. So we, when a patient's breathing for themselves, they draw air into the lungs, and when we ventilate them, we push air into the lungs. And so one of the things that we can do is we can increase the amount of pressure that's in the lungs to kind of open up the lungs, which is more difficult to do when the patient's awake. The other option is that we don't put the patient to sleep and we don't put a breathing tube down, but we put them on something called non-invasive ventilation, which is either a mask or a hood, which allows us to provide extra pressure whilst they breathe, and some pressure to splint open the lung sacs, the air sacs, but they continue to breathe. Now that can be effective as a holding measure, but sometimes it's not enough to be able to provide the oxygen levels that the patient needs. So often we might start with non-invasive ventilation, and then if the patient isn't getting better or they deteriorate, then we would proceed to put them off to sleep and then put them on a breathing machine. Now we have other machines and other therapies which allow us to support different organs. So for instance, if a patient's kidneys are not working very well and they start to fail, then we can put in big drips into the neck or the groin, which allow us to put them onto a kidney machine. Essentially, it's called hemofiltration. It's slightly different from dialysis, but the principle is the same. So essentially, we take over the work of the kidneys. And again, the same principle is that we do it until the patient's own kidneys start to recover, or until such a time as that they're ready to go to the ward, and then the renal team, the kidney specialist, will take them over with a view to planning possible long-term dialysis. And then with the heart, we can provide medicines that can't be provided on the ward, which have to be given through a big vein in the neck or the groin that can support the heart's function, or at least try to boost the heart's function as much as possible. But as I said, what we can fix is limited, but what we can do is we can provide support until either the body has healed itself or until the kind of the major problem that's brought them into intensive care has been kind of resolved. If, however, you've got already have very bad lung disease or very bad heart disease, there is nothing that we can do in intensive care to reverse that process. So we can only support the heart, the lungs, the kidneys whilst things improve. But if the heart and the lungs are already in a very poor state, we are not going to get them better than they were before they came to the unit.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that is a bit of a common misconception, that we fix things. We actually, what we do is we have a holding pattern until the problems that have brought them into the unit have been resolved for the most part anyway.
Yeah, and so that makes the starting point very important, how
that's
well
right,
the patient
yeah.
is to start with. And that is why there's this concept of some patients the decision being made not to send them to intensive care because they're unlikely to survive it, and it's kind of unfair to put their body through that when their survival is unlikely.
That's correct. So the very difficult decisions are made around which patients are appropriate to go to the intensive care units. And the reason why that is that, as I've said, so if a patient has got underlying heart or lung or kidney problems, we have to make decisions about, well, will we be able to, whilst this current illness is going on, will we be able to support them until this passes? And at the end of that process, will we be able to get them off a ventilator? Will we be able to get them off of a kidney machine? Will we be able to get them into a position where their heart will be able to function appropriately once we've stopped the medications that we're giving through these big drips? And that forms the basis of making a rational decision about who is appropriate to come to intensive care. And although we look at all the different organ systems and whether or not we can, because we always think that the most likely thing is that when someone has a disease affecting one of those individual organ systems, it's likely that the end of their stay in intensive care, that particular system, so either the heart, the lungs, or the kidneys, will be significantly worse off even when it's recovered than it was before. And that is just the nature of the fact that those lungs, those hearts, those kidneys have been affected by the disease, and they will not return to where they were before. They'll be slightly worse off.
Yeah, so it's a big stress to put the body under, isn't it, going to intensive care, in terms of the organ support is quite invasive, like ventilation or going on a kidney support hemofiltration machine.
We have to take into consideration the patient's wishes as well. So for instance, if we were to decide to take somebody to the intensive care unit to put them on a kidney machine, if it was very highly probable that after giving that treatment and waiting for whatever has caused the kidneys to fail further, they would not want to be on long-term dialysis, we have to think long and hard about whether we should take them to the intensive care unit to give them that treatment. Because if we use the treatment as a bridge, so for instance, if we were giving them some using the kidney machine to get over this sort of temporary kidney failure, and then afterwards they would be able to get back to normal function, or if afterwards they would be willing to accept going on to dialysis, so that means going three times a week for a hemodialysis, then that's very reasonable. So if the patient, you know, as long as their other medical conditions and their physical state beforehand means that they would be able to get through the whole business of going through intensive care. If, however, they're adamant they would not want to be put on hemodialysis under any circumstances, then there has to be a sort of ethical question as to whether or not it's appropriate to take them to the intensive care unit, knowing that they probably will end up on dialysis.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
And the same thing goes for patients who have got long-standing breathing problems, for instance. When we put people off to sleep and put a breathing tube down, we have to think about, will we be able to get that breathing tube out again? And the common misconception about the intensive care unit is that when we bring them to the unit, we put them off to sleep, put a breathing tube down, and then they're heavily sedated during the time they're there, which is a very common misconception, because actually we have to provide enough sedation for them to be able to bear having the tube in their throat, but we can't have so much sedation that the patients can't take an active part in their recovery. So it can be a very, very stressful time being in the intensive care unit, and there's a very high proportion of patients who come through intensive care end up with severe psychological sort of problems associated with it. Things like post-traumatic stress disorder is extremely common in patients who come through the unit. Now, the reason for that is that in order to get people well, we have to work them really hard, particularly if they're unwell when they come to us, with the aim that we are going to get them better. And that sometimes isn't a process which is entirely comfortable or pain-free. And as a result of that, we have to think long and hard about whether or not we want to put somebody who's, for instance, who's in their 80s or 90s, who is bedbound, who has got poor heart, lung and kidney function, whether or not it's really appropriate that we, inverted commas, do everything that we can for them, and by doing that, we put them in intensive care and we put them through these very aggressive, very unpleasant treatments for multiple weeks. And at the end of that, the patient still doesn't survive. And so it's not something that we just broadly say we should give everyone a go on the intensive care unit, and those that live, they live, and those that die, well, you know, that's we've tried our best, because actually it's a very unpleasant thing being put through the intensive care unit, and we wouldn't put someone on the intensive care unit without wanting to try to work them as hard as we could to get them off the intensive care unit. And I think that's a bit of a common misconception. So we've had patients of different age groups that have come through to the intensive care unit, and we generally see that the patients who are considerably older tend to do worse. However, we do have examples of where they've done very well. We've got a 79-year-old patient who has now got a tracheostomy, which means that they've got a tube that's been surgically placed into their neck to help them get off the ventilator, who is doing very well and will be discharged to the ward at some point. However, that has taken 3 weeks in order to get them to the point at which they can be discharged.
And at the moment, especially, another consideration to take into account is that relatives aren't able to visit in hospital at the moment.
That's right.
So patients are on intensive care on their own, which makes the responsibility of the staff, like you and the nursing staff, even greater, because that you're there sort of as a substitute for their families as well.
Yes, and the the current situation is very emotionally distressing, because we are seeing a lot of patients who come to us. We speak to them on the phone to explain that we are taking their relative to the intensive care unit because they've become very unwell, and that we need to put a breathing tube down to help them with their breathing. And then we explain to them that there's a very significant possibility that the patient may die. And then, as you have correctly pointed out, then the patient is on their own and none of the relatives can visit. So the only contact is really via phone. And then we have also had instances where one patient has come to the intensive care unit and then their partner has come the following week, and they have both died. And then possibly a brother or sister has died in some other hospital. So we're seeing entire families losing their relatives and their loved ones, and they're all on their own, and they have no means of having contact with their families. And as much as we can be surrogates for their families as best as we can, unfortunately, the thing that we see is that in order to try our best with these patients, they obviously are isolated, and sadly, some of these patients do die alone, which is incredibly sad.
This is so sad, and so important that people think about what they would want.
Yes,
and also, I guess, I don't know, that was making me think, like, how important it is. I know everyone's saying it, but to like limit the spread, like stay at home, because these things are happening when the virus is spreading more, and you can minimise that by minimising the spread.
Yep, staying at home so that these scenarios don't happen.
Absolutely right, Matilda. Yeah. The importance is that people realise that the actions that they're taking is not necessarily for themselves. It's to protect those that are most vulnerable in our society. Flouting the rules and going out and socializing, feeling like there's no consequences. There are consequences, but those consequences won't be felt individually by those people.
You might not see them
further down the line by those that are more vulnerable.
Those people with the weaker lungs or the weaker hearts, as we were saying.
Yeah. So in terms of coronavirus and intensive care, what kind of forms the decision of someone going to intensive care with coronavirus? Like, at what point does it get to where you then have to go to intensive care? That's something I don't...
Yeah, so what we tend to... The kind of flow of the patients through the hospital is that they present to the A&E unit, mm-hmm. so to casualty, and are seen by a casualty doctor who assesses them and then starts their treatment. And at that point, they will be referred to the medical doctors if they have problems with their breathing and they're thought to have potentially coronavirus on the basis of their symptoms, or potentially they may have been tested in the community and we might know that they have coronavirus. The medical doctors will come and look at the patient, and they will assess how much oxygen they are requiring at the moment, and also look at what the kind of trajectory is of the patient. So if the patient has come in and they've required very minimal oxygen, so you know, they're only requiring a very small amount of oxygen to help support them, but then within a course of a few hours they've started to require even more and even more oxygen, and it looks like the trajectory is that they're deteriorating quite quickly, that is something that normally we want to know about, the intensive mm-hmm. care unit. And so we will often be told about patients who seem to be getting worse quickly. The other sort of patients are the patients that are already on quite a high amount of oxygen, and they're on so much oxygen they haven't really got anywhere left to go. So what that means is that the amount of oxygen that is being able to be delivered to them on the wards it can no longer be increased. And that is the point at which we might become involved with the patients. Okay. Now, that is also tied into how much work the patient is having to do to breathe. So the patient might be on, say, 60% oxygen, but they're working very, very hard in order to keep their oxygen levels up, and they're breathing really heavily and they look like they're going to tire. And that's another reason where we might be brought in to be able to assess the patient for their suitability to come to the intensive care.
Okay, cool. So with, like, medically speaking about the virus, so does the virus affect the lungs then, which then makes it really difficult to breathe, right?
Yes, the virus does affect the lungs. How much it is directly the virus's damage to the lungs, and how much of this is to do with whether or not the virus is damaging the lungs, or possibly the blood supply around the small air sacs, but also what we think is that to some degree, a lot of the problems that we see are actually the body's own immune system, the body's own defense against infections, goes a bit crazy and causes what we describe as a cytokine storm, which basically means like a chemical storm of inflammatory agents, which basically cause the body's own immune system to attack these tissues.
So it's like the immune system going into overdrive.
Exactly. And as a consequence of that, you get this collateral damage where the tissues which the immune system is trying to combat the virus get damaged as a consequence of the immune system's own attempt to deal with the virus. And that's what we think that there's, this is very early on, and I'm no virologist, so I wouldn't claim to know the ins and outs. But at this stage, we think that it's not just the virus causing damage, but it's the immune system as well. And we're in the process of, there are lots of trials going on to see whether or not maybe modulating the immune system slightly might have effects to help reduce the kind of collateral damage that the immune system is doing to the body.
And any thoughts on why this is affecting men more than women in this way?
Some people are saying that it's because there's a higher amount of the associated comorbidities, so things like high blood pressure and obesity, and more men smoke and more men drink. So they say that maybe it's actually because men don't look after themselves as well, and therefore that's why, or they happen to have these other medical problems which seem to be associated with poor prognosis in coronavirus, or it might be something to do with the underlying genetics and the fact that men have a slightly weaker immune system. They're more prone to lots of different diseases, and we know that anyway. They have a lower life expectancy than women anyway.
Men are more often affected by infectious diseases like this, whereas women suffer more with autoimmune diseases.
Yes, which would seem to indicate that the women's immune system is almost is tuned up a bit higher on the volume than men's. So women get the problems associated with the immune system causing damage to itself, and men get the problems of not having such an effective immune system. But to be honest with you, at this early stage, to be able to see the wood through the trees is difficult. But there does seem to be a very clear association with men having a poorer outcome than women, particularly when they get more unwell. So when they're requiring admission to the intensive care unit and they need organ support, they tend to do much, much worse. I mean, in my own unit, at least 70% of the people in the unit are men.
Just going back to Boris Johnson, we don't want to speculate too hard here, but he has been admitted to intensive care, so presumably his oxygen requirements increased and that was the best place for him.
Yes. Yes, so his oxygen requirements probably increased, and he needed to go to the intensive care unit possibly to receive either non-invasive ventilation or some other form of oxygen delivery that they couldn't do on the ward. There's been some speculation as to whether or not he was admitted for observation. I mean, under normal circumstances, I would say that it isn't common for us to admit patients purely for observation, and if they look like they're going to deteriorate. I mean, he may have been admitted sort of early in order to see whether, because he was like one of those patients I just talked about, as in his trajectory looked like it was going in the wrong direction, and they thought he may very likely need to have either this non-invasive, this face mask that assists your breathing, or he might be going down the road where he needed to have a breathing tube put in. The fact that he's been in the unit for a few days, I mean, would seem to indicate that he's been extremely unwell from this virus. Whatever your political thoughts are, you know, I think our hearts go out to his pregnant fiance and his family, because I mean, this is it, regardless of where you sit on the political spectrum, this is a horrendous thing to have to go through for anyone.
And we wish him and his family well.
Yes, absolutely.
So like, I know you've kind of said, so intensive care doesn't mean, because I think a lot of people think intensive care means ventilator. Like, it doesn't mean that necessarily, does it?
It means organ support, doesn't it?
Exactly. It means organ support. So it, depending on what organ is failing, we can support that. So you can get some patients, for instance, patients who are already on a kidney machine or on long-term dialysis, sometimes they become unwell for other reasons and they come into hospital and they can't go to their normal dialysis because they're too unwell to. So they will come to us and we'll put them on our kidney machines. And the same thing goes, so that would be a single organ and that would, they wouldn't need to go onto a ventilator. They wouldn't be receiving necessarily any medicines to keep their blood pressure up. So that would be purely for their kidneys. And then we get patients with heart failure, for instance, where we might accept them and give them certain drugs that enable the heart to work a bit better, to get them over the hump of whatever has caused them to fall off their perch. And then that would again be a single organ. What commonly happens is that when patients are extremely unwell and are requiring more than one organ, often they do end up on a ventilator. And we can do all those things. And so the best place for them is to be in the intensive care unit. And then the other one that is becoming more common, but we don't know, it's difficult again to know how many of our patients have been suffering from this, is whether they sometimes develop a viral myocarditis. So they develop a problem with their heart associated with the virus. And we think that a few of our patients that have come through, their primary presentation has been associated with actually just a myocarditis type picture.
So are most of your patients on the your ward of a similar age?
Yes. Okay. So the majority of our patients are between 50 and 65. And then there are some 70-year-olds, 80-year-olds, and there's some patients, a couple of patients that are younger than that. But we do have, I mean, we've got some patients that are in their 80s who are very, very fit.
Yeah.
So obviously it's a case by case basis. And so if you're somebody who's more elderly, but you're a very fit person without many medical problems, then you would still be appropriate to come to the unit at this stage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much for that insight, Ben. That was really useful. I think people will find that really interesting. I would like to talk about something a bit more positive, which is about what you're going to go off and do after you finish this interview.
I'm going to go and see my children at a distance. I've been sadly, my family have moved up. My partner and my two children have moved up with her mum in Cambridge, and to try to protect them as best as I can, because I'm being exposed so much to the virus on a daily basis. And so I'm living on my own in our house, and my partner and my children are up in Cambridge. So I'm going to go up in the car and have my mask on and gloves on and sort of wave to them at a distance and say hello and tell them I love them before I go off to work this evening.
Oh, that's amazing. So nice. How lovely.
Yeah.
Well, have a good journey.
Thank you.
And hope your shift tonight is okay.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to Ben for coming on and talking so openly about your experiences. We would like to reiterate that obviously most cases of coronavirus are mild or asymptomatic, 80% or maybe a bit more. So we're talking here with Ben about the most severe cases. Mm. And it does bring up the sort of planning of the care that you would want if you got severely ill, and in general practice we're trying to encourage patients to do that. It's not we're not pressurizing patients to do it or anything like that, but it makes sense to think about if you were severely ill what you would want. Tilly and I have had to talk about that, about what I would want and what she would want, and I think it's a good idea for anybody to do that. It's also brought up the issue of do not attempt CPR, DNA CPR certificates. And there's a lot of controversy about that. There's a kind of school of thought that says that they mean that people, that if someone has a do not resuscitate order in place, that people are going to give up on them if they're ill. But that's not true. It just means if your heart stops, would somebody attempt cardiopulmonary resuscitation, which is chest compressions, which is a significant kind of insult to the body. It can break ribs, and it's a sort of violent thing to do.
Invasive.
Yeah. So if somebody would rather not have that, if their body is frail already, then they can choose not to have that. And a lot of elderly people would rather not have that.
Mm.
In fact, if somebody's really ill, it's the doctors at the time on a case-by-case basis who decide what the best thing is to do. So there's no pressure on people to decide whether or not to have that. It's actually the decision of the medical team. But obviously, if you're going to do one of those, then you do it in discussion with the patient and their family. And there's a really good article that I read this week by a palliative care doctor called Rachel Clark that was in The Guardian that I'm going to post a link to on the podcast description. And she goes through what DNA CPR means really clearly. And so I think that's really worth reading. And yeah, in terms of advanced care planning, that's just planning what you would want if you got really ill, whether you would want to go to intensive care, whether you would want to stay at home, things like that. So really worth a chat. And GPs specialise in this kind of thing because they're having to manage it a lot in the community. So if you want to have a discussion about all of this, please have a chat with your GP.
Yeah. It's often a thing, like a topic that you would want to avoid, and kind of, it sounds horrible, to be honest, and something like, why would you say that? That's so horrible. But it is actually kind of useful, and I think we don't talk about these things enough, and this virus is really kind of pushing us to confront these conversations and these things. So, yeah.
And we'll have more about it in the next episode.
Yeah.
And one of the most uplifting, informative interviews we've done.
Yeah.
So tune into the next one for more about that, about facing your fears and talking about the kind of unspeakable.
Yeah. On to our positive news, something a bit lighter to end the episode.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a bit about how being in quarantine with my lovely 19-year-old daughter means I'm learning a lot about her, and especially her language.
Mm.
So one of the words I've learned this week is bummy.
I don't know why you're so obsessed with this word that I literally said like once.
It just really makes me laugh. I don't know why. So Tilly, what does bummy mean?
Well, I'm sure most people listening can know or have an idea. I don't really, like, it's one of those words that's hard to explain. It just means like, it can mean two things, but it's kind of the same vibe. So one could be if you work really hard at an assignment, say, and then you don't do well even though you worked hard, you could say that's so bummy. Or it can mean, you can describe it about a person. It could be like a very lazy person who doesn't do much with their life.
Oh yeah, I think that's when I first heard it.
Don't say that. That's
so
like
bummy.
I wasn't saying it about someone, but I was saying they felt like they were getting that way. But yeah, it just means, you know, someone who's just lazy, doesn't, like, not productive. Yeah.
I love it.
So there you go, everyone.
That's our teenage vernacular next time
of the week. My word. My positive thing is I have been loving pub quizzes. Like, I've been playing I've had one nearly every night this week.
They're taking the world by storm.
Yeah, they are. I made my own round, which was, I really was proud of, to be honest. It was I made a round where all the answers had a link. It was so fun making questions and like doing them as well, finding out more stuff. I just love them. You're all on Zoom with a little drink and something to do together. It's so fun. So I would say if you're bored or whatever, or you're trying to organize something on Zoom, do a pub quiz. It's so fun. Or if you've been invited to one, like, do it. You'll have a really good time.
Yeah, so much fun.
Yeah.
And one of the things Tilly is doing with her friends as a game is something called photo roulette.
Yeah.
Which I haven't heard much about generally, but you and your friends find it hilarious.
Yeah, we've started playing it.
Pretty savage.
I actually first was introduced it by my two girls that I babysit for. They were like, do you play photo roulette? And I was like, what is that? Basically, it's a game. It's a silly game. It's where you all join this game, like, by putting a game pin in. You have to download an app called Photo Roulette to play. It picks random photos from everyone's camera rolls, and you have to, and one at a time, it shows them up, and you have to guess whose photo it is. So obviously, it can bring up some pretty funny photos from years ago when you look really, like, young or whatever. Yeah, that's a fun online game I've been playing. And another one I've been playing with friends on Zoom is an online game called Psych, which is a lot more well known, which is kind of similar. You all download the app, join a game, and then it will take everyone's name in the game and ask questions about them. Like, if Tilly were to write a book, what would it, a self-help book, what would it be called? And you have to do answers, and
it's anonymous, isn't it, the answering?
Yeah, to begin with, all the answers come up and you don't know whose is whose, and then you pick your favorite answer, and then at the end you see whose everyone answers was and whose answer got the most points.
And they're really harsh and horrible to each other.
Yeah, we are, but it's fun. It's some way to pass the time and laugh. It makes you laugh a lot. If you want to laugh more, play those games. But yeah, they're just silly games that I've been playing.
Aw, really fun.
Yeah.
Well, thank you everybody for joining us again. We really hope you enjoyed the episode.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening. And as always, any questions, tips, feedback to questions@coronacast.co.uk.
We really appreciate your support, and you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram as well @TheCoronaCast. We look forward to hearing from you.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Stay safe.
Bye.